here and close to the edge of the woods, so that they were shaded by trees and smelled of dankness and rot. They came to a foul-smelling stream and crossed it by a slippery, primitive bridge of logs. Thomas took her hand and helped her. It was treacherous with her bad leg, and she feared slipping into the water, which was quite shallow but clogged with filth. On the other side of the stream, beyond the thick, poisonous oleander bushes that were such a danger to Tykes, lay the area known as the Fen. In some ways it was similar to the place that Kira had called home. The small cots, close together, the incessant wailing of infants, the stench of smoky fires, rotting food, and unwashed humans. But it was darker here, with the trees thick overhead, and festering with dampness and an odor of ill health.
"Why must there be such a horrible place?" Kira whispered to Thomas. "Why do people have to live like this?"
"It's how it is," he replied, frowning. "It's always been." A sudden vision slid into Kira's mind. The robe. The robe told how it had always been, and what Thomas had said was not true. There had been times, oh, such long ago times, when people's lives had been golden and green. Why could there not be such times again? She began to say it to him.
"Thomas," she suggested, "you and I, we're the ones who will fill in the blank places. Maybe we can make it different."
But she saw how he was looking at her. His look was skeptical, amused. "What are you talking about?" He didn't understand. Perhaps he never would.
"Nothing," Kira told him, shaking her head.
As they walked, an ominous quiet fell. Kira became aware of eyes. Women stood in shadowed doorways, watching them suspiciously. Kira limped along, trying to find ways around the garbage-strewn puddles in the path, and felt the hostile stares. It made no sense, she knew, to walk without a destination through this unfamiliar, malevolent place.
"Thomas," she murmured, "we must ask someone."
He stopped, and she stopped beside him. They stood uncertainly in the path.
"What be your purpose?"
a hoarse voice called from an open window. Kira looked and saw a green lizard slither into the vines at the sill. Behind the fluttering wet leaves, a gaunt-faced woman was holding a tyke in her arms and looking out. There seemed no men around. She realized the men, mostly draggers and diggers, would all be working, and she felt relieved, remembering how they had grabbed at her the day of the weapons. Kira made her way through the thorny underbrush and went closer to the window. Through it she could see the dark interior of the cot, where several other tykes, half-naked, stood staring dull-eyed and frightened toward her.
"I'm looking for the boy called Matt," she said politely to the woman. "Do you know where he lives?"
"What you be giving me for it?"
"Giving you? I'm sorry," Kira told her, startled by the question. "I don't have anything to give."
"Nary food?"
"No, I'm sorry."
Kira held her hands out, showing that they were empty. "I have an apple." Thomas approached, and to Kira's surprise, took a dark red apple from his pocket. "I saved it from lunch," he explained to Kira in a low voice, and he held it toward the woman. Her thin arm reached out from the open window and grabbed the fruit. She bit at it and began to turn away.
"Wait," Kira said. "The cot, where Matt lives. Can you tell us, please?"
The woman turned back, her mouth full.
"Further down," she said, chewing noisily.
The infant in her arms grabbed at the bitten apple, and she shoved its hands away. She gestured with her head.
"There be a busted tree in front."
Kira nodded.
"And please, one more thing," she pleaded. "What can you tell us about a tyke named Joe?"
The woman's face changed, and Kira found it hard to interpret the look. For a moment, a brief flicker of joy had washed across the thin, embittered face. Then hopelessness replaced it.
"The little singing girl," the woman said, her voice a hoarse whisper. "She be tooken. They tooken her away."
She turned away abruptly and disappeared into the shadowed interior of the cot. Her children began to cry and to claw at her for food. The gnarled tree was dying, split almost to the ground, and rotting. Perhaps it had once borne fruit, but now its limbs were broken, dangling at odd angles, punctuated by occasional wisps of brown leaves. The small cot behind the tree looked damaged and neglected, too. But there were voices inside, a woman speaking roughly, and a sharp-tongued child answering her in an angry, spiteful tone. Thomas knocked. The voices became quiet, and finally the door opened slightly.
"Who you be?"
the woman asked abruptly.
"We're friends of Matt's," Thomas told her. "Is he inside? Is he all right?" "Who be it, Mum?"
the child's voice called. The woman peered at Thomas and Kira silently, not answering. Finally, Thomas called to the child.
"Is Matt at home? What's he done now? What you be wanting him for?"
the woman asked, her eyes glinting with mistrust.
"He runned off, and took in food, too,"
a tyke called to them. His head, thick with tousled, unkempt hair, appeared beside the woman. He pushed the door open wider. Kira looked in dismay at the cot's dark interior. A pitcher, overturned on a table, lay in a puddle of some thick liquid through which insects crawled. The tyke at the door picked his nose with one finger, scratched himself with the other hand, and stared at them. His mother coughed wetly and then spat something to the floor.
"Do you know where he went?"
Kira asked, trying not to show how shocked she felt at the condition of these people. The woman shook her head and coughed again.
"Good rid to him," she said.
She shoved the tyke to the side and pulled the heavy wooden door closed. After a moment, Kira and Thomas turned away. Behind them, they heard the door open.
"Miss, I know where Matt goed,"
the tyke's voice said. He emerged from the cot despite his mother's scolding voice and came to them. He was clearly Matt's brother. He had the same bright, mischievous eyes. They waited.
"What you give me?"
His finger went into his nose again. Kira sighed. Life in the fen was apparently a series of barters. No wonder Matt had become such a clever manipulator and entrepreneur. She looked helplessly at Thomas.
"We don't have anything to give you," she explained to the tyke.
He eyed her appraisingly.
"How about that there, miss?"
he suggested, pointing to Kira's neck. She touched the thong from which hung the polished stone.
"No,"
she told the tyke, and her fingers curled protectively around the stone.
"This was my mother's. I can't give it to you."
To her surprise, he nodded, as if that made sense to him.
"That there, then?"
He pointed to her hair. Kira remembered that she had tied it back that morning, as she often did, with a simple leather cord of no value. Quickly, she pulled it loose and held it out. The tyke grabbed it and thrust it into his pocket. It seemed to be a satisfactory payment.
"Our mum, she thrashed Matt so hard he was horrid bloody, and so him and Branchy, they go down a journey, and they not be coming back, not to the fen,"
the tyke announced.
"Matt, he got friends who be taking good care of him, not thrashing him never, and they give him food, too."
Thomas laughed a little.
"And they make him take baths,"
he added, though the tyke just stared, not understanding the word.
"But he meant us," Kira pointed out. "We're the friends he meant."
She was concerned. "If he tried to come to us, where is he? It was 2 days ago that he left here, and no one's seen him since. He knew the way to—" Matt's brother interrupted her.
"Him and Branchy, they goed someplace else first. He be getting a gifty for his friends. That be you, miss, and you?"
He looked at Thomas. They nodded.
"Matt, he say that a gifty makes a person like you best of all."
Kira sighed in exasperation.
"No, that's not the way it is. A gift—"
she gave up.
"Never mind. Tell us where he went."
"He be getting you some blue."
"Blue? What do you mean?"
"Dunno, miss, but Matt, he said it. He be saying they got blue yonder, and he be getting you some."
The woman reappeared in the open doorway and called in a shrill and angry voice to the tyke, who retreated inside. Thomas and Kira turned away and began to retrace their steps on the muddy path back toward the village. Silent watchers still lurked in doorways. The fetid air still hung humid. Kira whispered to Thomas, "When Matt disappeared, I thought perhaps we would find that he had been taken, too, like Joe."
"If he'd been taken," Thomas suggested, "we'd know his whereabouts. He'd be there with us in the council edifice."
Kira nodded. "And with Joe, although maybe they'd have locked him up like her. He'd hate that."
"Matt would find a way to get free," Thomas pointed out. "Anyway," he added, helping Kira find her way around a puddle with a dead rat in it, "they wouldn't want Matt, I'm afraid. They only want us for our skills, and he hasn't any."
Kira thought of the impish boy, of his generosity and his laughter, of his devotion to the little dog. She thought of him now, wherever he was, on his quest to bring a gift to friends.
"Oh, Thomas," she said, "he does. He knows just how to make us smile and laugh."
There seemed no hint of laughter or any history of it in this terrible place. Making her way through the squalor, Kira remembered Matt's infectious chortle. She thought, too, of the clear purity of the small singer's voice, and how the two children must have been the only elements of joy here. Now Joe had been taken away, and Matt was gone as well. She wondered where he could have journeyed, all alone but for the dog, to search for Blue.
Chapter 18. The day of the gathering was approaching. Its nearness was palpable in the village. People began to finish projects and delayed the start of new ones. Kira noticed that in the weaving shed, fabrics were folded and stacked, but the looms were not restrung. The noise level subsided, as if people were distracted with preparations and didn't want to waste time with the usual bickering. Some people washed. In his room, Thomas was meticulously polishing the singer's staff again and again. He used thick oils and rubbed them into the wood with a soft cloth. Smooth and golden, it began to take on a glow and fragrance. Matt did not return. It had been many days now since he had disappeared. At night, before she slept, Kira held the scrap of cloth that had so often assuaged her fears and even answered her questions. She wrapped it around her fingers and concentrated on Matt. She pictured the laughing boy and sought some feeling of where he might be and whether he was safe. A feeling of reassurance, of solace, came from the scrap. But no answer. They could occasionally hear the voice of the small singer, Joe, during the day. The crying had ceased. Most often they heard repetitive chanting, the same phrases over and over, though sometimes, as if she were allowed a moment of her own, the high lyrical voice soared into melodies that made Kira hold her breath in awe. She crept down at night with the key in her hand and visited the tyke. Joe had stopped asking for her mother, but she clung to Kira in the darkness. Together they whispered little stories and jokes. Kira brushed Joe's hair.
"I could thump with a hairbrush if and I needed,"
Joe reminded her, looking up at the ceiling.
"Yes, and we would come."
Kira stroked Joe's soft cheek.
"Want I should make a song for you?"
Joe asked.
"Someday," Kira told her, "but not now. We mustn't make noise in the night. It must be our secret that I come here."
"I be thinking up a song,"
Joe said,
"and someday I sing it for you horrid loud."
"All right," Kira laughed.
"The gathering be soon,"
Joe said importantly.
"Yes, I know."
"I be right up front, they say."
"Good for you. So you'll be able to see everything. You'll be able to see the beautiful singer's robe. I've been working on it," Kira told her. "It has wonderful colors."
"When I be singer," the tyke confided, "then I can make my own songs again, if and I learn the old ones good."
When Jameson came to her room, Kira showed him that the repairs to the robe were complete. He was obviously pleased with her work. Together they spread the fabric across the table, turning it, unfolding its pleating and cuffs, examining the intricate stitches and the seams they created. "You've done a fine job, Kira," he said, "particularly here." He pointed to a place that she recalled had been difficult for her. Though tiny in size, as each embroidered seam was, it was a complicated portrayal of tall buildings in shades of gray, each of them toppling against a background of fiery explosions. Kira had matched oranges and reds of different shades and had found the various grays for the smoke and the buildings. But the threading had been hard for her because she had no sense of what the buildings were. She had never seen anything like them. The council edifice in which she lived and worked was the only large building she knew, and it was small compared to these. These, before they toppled, had seemed to extend up into the sky to amazing heights, much, much higher than any tree she had ever seen. "That was the hardest part," she told Jameson. "It was so complicated. Perhaps if I had known more about the buildings, about what happened to them..." She was embarrassed. "I should have paid more attention to the ruin song each year," she confessed. "I was always so excited when it began, but then my mind would wander a bit, and I didn't always listen carefully."
"You were young," Jameson reminded her, "and the song is very, very long. No one listens carefully to every part, and especially not the tykes."
"This year I will," Kira told him. "This year I'll be paying special attention because I know the scenes so well. I'll be listening especially for this scene, with the buildings falling." Jameson closed his eyes. She could see his lips move silently. He started to hum, and she recognized a recurrent melody from part of the song. Then he began to chant aloud. "Burn, scourged world, furious furnace, inferno impure." He opened his eyes.
"I believe that's the part," he said. "It goes on and on after that. I forget the next words, but I believe that's the part where the buildings toppled. Of course, I've listened to the song for many more years than you."
"I can't imagine how the singer remembers it all," Kira said. For a moment she thought of asking him about the captive child below, the singer of the future, who was being forced to learn the interminable song. But she hesitated, and the moment passed.
"Of course, he has the staff as a guide," Jameson said. "And he began the learning when he was just a small tyke. That was a very long time ago. And he rehearses constantly. While you've been preparing his robe, he's been preparing this year's song. The words are always the same, of course, but I believe he decides each year to emphasize certain parts. He studies all year, planning and rehearsing the singing of it."
"Where?"
"He has special quarters in a different section of the edifice."
"I've never seen him except at the time of the song."
"No, he stays apart."
They turned again to the robe, examining each section to be certain that Kira had missed nothing. A tender brought tea, and they sat together, talking of the robe and its stories, of the history it told, of the time before the ruin. Jameson closed his eyes again and recited,
"Ravaged all. Bogota, Baltimore, Toronto, too, now gone."
Kira recognized the lines, some of her favorites, though she didn't understand them. As a tyke, the rhyming sounds had charmed her out of the boredom she often felt during the interminable song.
"Bogota, Baltimore, Toron,"
she had chanted to herself at times. "What does it mean, that section?" she asked Jameson now.
"I believe it tells the names of lost places," he explained.
"I wonder what those places looked like. Timor, Toron. I like the sounds."
"That's part of your job," Jameson reminded her. You use the threads to remind us of how they looked. Kira nodded and smoothed the robe again, finding the tragic toppling cities and the interspersed meadows of soft greens. Jameson set his teacup on the table, went to the window, and looked down. The workers are finished. After the gathering and this year's song, you'll be able to start dyeing new threads for the robe. She looked up, dismayed, hoping to see by his expression that he was making a small joke. But his look was solemn. Kira had thought that when this work was complete, she could turn to her own projects, to some of the elaborate patterns that she could feel and see in her mind. Sometimes her fingers quivered with the desire to make those scenes. "Will the robe become so damaged during the song that it will need repairing again?" she asked him, trying not to show how distressing the thought was to her. She wanted to please him. He had been her protector, but she didn't want to keep doing this forever.
"No, no." His voice was reassuring. "Your mother kept up with the small repairs each year, and now you've very capably redone the places that needed restoration. After this year's song, there will probably be only a few scattered, broken threads for you to fix."
"Then..." Kira was puzzled. Jameson reached toward the robe and gestured at the empty, unadorned expanse across the shoulders. "Here lies the future," he said. "And now you will tell it to us, with your fingers and your threads," he told her. His eyes had a piercing, excited look. She tried to conceal her shock.
"So soon?" she murmured.
He had referred to this enormous task before, but she had thought that when she was older, when she had more skill, more knowledge. "We have waited a long time for you," he said, and looked at her firmly, as if he dared her to refuse.
Chapter 19. It began early. At dawn, Kira could hear the sounds, even from her room on the opposite side of the building, as the people started to gather. Quickly, she finished dressing, pulled the brush through her hair, and ran to Thomas's room on the other side of the corridor. From there, they could look down at the plaza where all large gatherings took place. Unlike the day of the hunt, this crowd was subdued. Even small tykes, usually so unruly, clung to their mother's hands and waited quietly. The sound that had awakened Kira was not shouts and jostling, but simply the tread of feet as the people streamed up the narrow lanes and moved into the throng waiting to enter the building. From the fen path came a steady flow of silent citizens clutching and leading their tykes. From the opposite direction, from the area where Kira and her mother had lived, came others whom she recognized from her old neighborhood. There was her mother's widowed brother with his boy, Dan. But the small girl, Mar, was not with him. Perhaps she had been given away. On a typical day, families were scattered and apart, tykes scampering unsupervised, parents at work. But today, hubbies stood with their wives and tykes with their families. The people seemed solemn and expectant.
"Where's the staff?" Kira asked, looking around Thomas's room.
"They took it yesterday."
Kira nodded.
They had come and taken the robe yesterday as well. Weary though she was of the work, her room seemed diminished with it gone.
"Should we go down?" she asked him, though she didn't relish the prospect of joining the crowd.
"No, they said they'd come for us. I asked the tender who brought my breakfast."
"Look!" Thomas pointed. "Over there, way in the back. See, by the tree? Just before the weaving shed? Isn't that Matt's mother?"
Kira followed his pointing finger with her eyes and found the same gaunt woman who had eyed them suspiciously from the squalor of the cot. Today she was washed and tidy. Beside her, holding her hand, was the tyke who looked so much like Matt. The two stood waiting as a family, but there was no second child, no Matt. A wave of sorrow swept through Kira, a feeling of loss. Looking down at the sea of faces, Kira gradually recognized people here and there. The weaving women, separate from each other, each with a hubby and children. The butcher, clean for a change, with his large wife and two tall sons. The entire village had gathered now, only a few stragglers still hurrying up the lanes. A small surge of movement began, and she could see that the people were shuffling forward. The crowd rippled like water moving on the river bank when a log floated by.
"The doors must have been opened," Thomas said, leaning forward to see.
They watched as the entire village, person by person, entered the building. Finally, when the crowd outside was almost entirely gone, and now they could hear the murmur of voices and the shuffle of footsteps from below inside the building, a tender appeared in Thomas's doorway and beckoned.
"It's time," the tender said.
Except for a quick peek through a cracked open door when she looked for Jameson one afternoon, Kira had not seen inside the Council of Guardians Hall since the day of her trial, months before. The circumstances had been so different then, when she entered the cavernous room and limped alone down its central aisle, hungry, lonely, and fearful for her life. Today she still leaned, as she had that day, on her stick, but now she was clean, healthy, and unafraid. Today she and Thomas were brought through a side entrance near the front, so that they saw the faces of the village watching them. The tender pointed, directing them to a row of three wooden chairs on the left, just below the stage, facing the audience. Kira could see that there was another, longer row of chairs on the opposite side, and she recognized the Council of Guardians members who were already seated there. Jameson was among them. Quickly, reminding herself of the custom, she bowed her head toward the worship object on the stage. Then she followed Thomas, and together they took their places in two of the chairs. A murmur passed through the audience, and Kira felt her face flush in embarrassment. She didn't like being singled out. She didn't want to sit here at the front. She remembered the derisive voice of one of the weavers only a few days before.
"She don't need us no more,"
the woman had called.
"It's not true. I need all of you. We need each other."
Gazing at the crowded audience, Kira remembered the many past years when she had come dutifully with her mother to the gathering. Always they sat in the back where she couldn't see or hear, and she had endured the event bored and restless, sometimes kneeling on her seat to try to peer around the spectators' shoulders and get a glimpse of the singer. Her mother, she remembered, had always been attentive and had gently restrained her when she wriggled in the seat. But the gathering and the song were long and difficult for Tykes. The people in the crowded audience, who, though respectful, had been shifting in their seats and whispering, quieted completely when Kira and Thomas entered and took their places. Everyone waited. Finally, in the silence, the four-syllable chief guardian, whom Kira had not seen since the trial and whose name she still could not recall—was it Bartholomew, perhaps? Rose from his seat on the other side. He walked to the space at the front of the stage and began the ritual that always opened the ceremony.
"The gathering begins," he announced. "We worship the object," he said, gesturing toward the stage and bowing.
The entire audience bowed respectfully toward the little crossed construction of wood.
"I present the Council of Guardians," he said next, and nodded to the row of men, which included Jameson.
As a group, they stood. For a nervous moment, Kira couldn't remember if the spectators were supposed to applaud. But a hush had fallen, and the crowd was silent, though some heads seemed to nod toward the Council of Guardians in respect.
"For the first time, I present the Carver of the Future."
He gestured toward Thomas, who looked uncertain.
"Stand,"
Kira whispered under her breath, knowing intuitively that it was the proper thing to do. Thomas stood awkwardly, shifting from one foot to the other. Again, heads nodded in respect. He sat back down. She knew that she would be next, and she reached for her stick, which was leaning against the chair.
"For the first time, I present the Robe Threader, the designer of the future."
Kira stood as straight as she could and acknowledged the nods in her direction. She sat again.
"For the first time, I present the singer of the future. One day, she will wear the robe."
The eyes of the villagers all turned to the side door, which had opened. Kira could see two tenders push Joe forward, pointing to the unoccupied chair. The tyke, dressed in a new but simple and unadorned gown, looked confused and uncertain, but her eyes found Kira's and Kira beckoned to her, smiling. Joe grinned and hurried forward toward the chair.
"Don't sit yet," Kira whispered. "Stand and look at the people. Be proud."
With a shy grin, with one foot nervously rubbing the ankle of the other leg, the singer of the future stood and faced the crowd. Her smile, hesitant at first, quickly became both self-confident and infectious. Kira could see the people smile back.
"Now you can sit," Kira whispered.
"Wait,"
Joe whispered back. She raised one hand and waggled her fingers at the audience. A ripple of gentle laughter ran through the large crowd. Then Joe turned and hoisted her small self, knees first, onto the chair.
"I'd be giving them a little wavy,"
she confided to Kira.
"Finally, I present our singer, who wears the robe,"
the chief guardian announced when the people had quieted. The singer, wearing the magnificent robe and holding the carved staff in his right hand, entered from the other side. The crowd gasped collectively. Of course they saw him and the robe each year, but this year was different because of the work that Kira had done on the ancient embroidery. As the singer moved toward the stage, the folds of the robe glistened in the torchlight. The colors of the threaded seams glowed in their subtlety. Golds, light yellows deepening to vibrant orange, reds from the palest pink to the darkest crimson, greens, all shades, threaded in their intricate patterns, told the history of the world and its ruin. As he turned to mount the few stairs to the stage, Kira could see the broad blank expanse across the singer's back and shoulders, the blank that she had been picked to fill, the future that she had been chosen to create. "What's that noise?" Thomas murmured. Kira had been distracted by her awareness and appreciation of the robe and all that it meant, but now she heard it too, a dull, intermittent, metallic noise, a muted clank. Now it was gone. There, she heard it again, a scraping clank. "I don't know," she whispered back. The singer turned at the center of the stage, after bowing slightly to the worship object, and now faced the audience. He fingered the staff like a talisman, but did not need its guidance yet. His face was impassive, expressionless. Then he closed his eyes and began to breathe deeply. The mysterious sound had disappeared. Kira listened carefully, but the muted scrape had subsided. Looking at Thomas, she shrugged and settled back to listen. She glanced at Joe and could see that the tyke's eyes were closed too, and she was forming the first words silently with her mouth. The singer held up one arm, and Kira, from her knowledge of the robe, knew that he was displaying the sleeve with the scene of the world's origin, the separation of land and sea, the emergence of fish and birds, all of it in the tiniest stitches around the border of the left sleeve, aloft now with his arm outstretched. She could feel the awed admiration of the audience as they saw the robe displayed for the first time in a year, and she felt pride in the work she had done. He started in a strong, rich baritone voice. No melody yet, really. The song began with a chant. Gradually, melodies would enter, Kira recalled. Some slow, soaring, lyrical phrases, followed by other harsher phrases with a quick, pulsating beat. But it emerged slowly, as the world had. The song began with the origin of the world, so many centuries before. In the beginning.
Chapter 20. Thomas nudged her and gestured with his head. Kira glanced over and smiled to see Joe, so eager and squirming earlier, now sound asleep in the big chair. It was late morning, and the song had continued for several hours. Probably many of the tykes in the large hall were dozing, as Joe was. Kira was surprised not to be bored and drowsy herself. But for her, the song was also a journey through the patterned folds, and as the singer sang, holding up the related parts, she remembered each scene and the days of work, the search through Annabella's threads for exactly the right shades. Though she remained attentive, occasionally her mind wandered to her own task that loomed ahead. Now that the old dyer's threads were almost gone, and the woman herself was gone, too, Kira found herself desperately hoping that she would be able to remember and to create the dyes alone. Thomas drilled her again and again from his written pages. Though Kira had told no one, not even Thomas, she had realized recently, to her surprise, that she could read many of the words. Watching his finger on the page one day, she had noticed that goldenrod and greenwood began the same way, with a looping downward curve. And they ended the same way, too, with a little twig-like upright line. It was like a game to find the marks that made the sounds. A forbidden game, to be sure, but Kira found herself puzzling over it often when Thomas wasn't watching, and the puzzles had begun to explain themselves to her. The singer was in a quiet section now. One of those times following a great world disaster in which ice, white and gray sheets of it, made with small stitches so that it had no texture, but instead an eerie, glistening smoothness, had engulfed the villages. Kira saw ice very seldom, only occasionally in the very coldest months when sleet struck the village, breaking tree branches, and the river froze near its banks. But she had remembered the fearsomeness and destruction of it when she worked on that section, and had felt glad when, beyond the edges of the ice disaster, green seeped in again, and a quiet, fruitful time ensued. He slid into the singing of the green part now, melodic and soothing, a relief after the frigid destruction that had made his voice harsh and forbidding. Thomas leaned over and nudged her again. She glanced at Joe, but the tyke had not moved.
"Look down the aisle on the right," Thomas whispered.
She did, and saw nothing.
"Keep watching," Thomas murmured.
The singer's voice continued. Kira watched the side aisle. Suddenly she saw it. Something moving stealthily, slowly, stopping now and then and waiting, then creeping forward again. People's heads blocked her view. Kira leaned slightly to the right, trying to see around them, trying not to let the Council of Guardians know that something disruptive was happening. She glanced at them, but they were all attentive and focused on the singer. It moved again in the shadows, and she could see now that it was human, a small human, on all fours like a stalking beast. She could see, too, that people sitting on the edge of the aisle were beginning to notice, though they kept their eyes toward the stage. There was a very small stir, shoulders turning slightly, quick glances, expressions of surprise. The small human crept forward again, inching stealthily closer to the first row. As he approached, it was easier for Kira to watch without changing her position, since her chair faced the audience, away from the stage. Finally, as the intruder reached the edge of the first row, he stopped creeping, squatted, and looked forward toward the stage, toward Kira, Joe, and Thomas, with a grin. Kira's heart leaped.
"Matt!"
She didn't dare to speak aloud, but she mouthed the word silently. He wiggled his fingers in a wave. The singer inched his fingers up the staff, feeling for the place, and continued. Matt grinned and opened one hand to show her something, but the light was dim. Kira didn't recognize what he held. He held it up between his thumb and finger, displaying it to her importantly. She shook her head slightly, indicating that she couldn't tell what it was.
Then, feeling guilty at her lapse in attention, she turned and began to watch the stage and the singer again. Soon she knew there would be an intermission, a break for lunch. She would figure out a way to catch up with the tyke then and examine and admire whatever he had brought. Kira listened to the singer's voice as he sang the serene melody of plentiful harvests and celebratory feasting. This part of the song coincided with her own feelings at the moment. She experienced an enormous sense of relief and joy now that Matt had returned and was safe. When she looked back, he had crept away again, and the aisle was empty. May the little singer have lunch with Thomas and me? It was the midday interruption of the gathering, a lengthy gap in the day for food and rest. The tender pondered Kira's question and agreed. Leaving by the side door through which they had entered, Kira and Thomas, accompanied by Joe, yawning, went up the stairs to Kira's room and waited for their food to be brought. On the plaza outside, the people would be eating the food they had brought with them and discussing the song. They would be anticipating the next section, a time of warfare, conflict, and death. Kira remembered it, the bright splatters of blood and crimson threads. But she put it out of her mind now. While Thomas and Joe began on the large lunch that appeared on a tray, she hurried across the hall to Thomas's room to look down from the window and scan the crowd for a dirty-faced tyke and a bent-tailed dog. But there was no need to search from the window. They were waiting for her in Thomas's room. "Matt!" Kira cried. She set her stick aside, sat on the bed, and took him into her arms. Branch danced at her feet, his eager nose and tongue damp on her ankles. "I been on a horrid long journey," Matt told her proudly. She sniffed and smiled. "And you never washed, not once, while you were gone." "There be no time for washing," he scoffed. "I brung you a giftie," he told her eagerly, his eyes dancing with excitement.
"What was it that you held up at the gathering? I couldn't see it."
"I brung you two things, a big and a little. The big be coming still. But I got the little here in my pocket."
He dug one hand deep into his pocket and pulled out a handful of nuts and a dead grasshopper.
"Nope, be the other side."
Matt put the grasshopper on the floor for Branch, who grabbed it with his teeth and consumed it with a crunch that made Kira cringe. The nuts rolled under the bed. Matt plunged his hand into the opposite pocket and brought out something triumphantly.
"Here you be."
He handed the thing to her. She took the folded thing curiously and plucked the dead leaf pieces and dirt away. Then, while Matt watched with delight and pride suffusing his face, she unfolded it and held it to the window light. A square of filthy, wrinkled cloth. Nothing more. And yet it was everything.
"Matt," Kira said, her voice hushed with awe. "You found blue."
He beamed.
"It were there, where she said."
"Where who said?"
"She. The old woman who makin' the colors. She said, there be blue yonder."
He wiggled in excitement.
"Annabella?" "Yes, I remember. She did say that."
Kira smoothed the cloth on the table, examining it. The deep blue was rich and even, the color of sky, of peace.
"But how did you know where, Matt? How did you know where to go?"
He shrugged, grinning.
"I recollect she pointed. I just followed where her point went. There be a path. But it's horrid far."
"And dangerous, Matt. It's through the woods."
"There be not fearful in the woods."
"There be no beasts," Annabella had said.
"Me and Branchy, we walk for days and days. Branch, he ate bugs. And me, I had some food I took in—"
"From your mother?"
He nodded with a guilty look.
"But it weren't enough. After it be all gone, I ate nuts mostly. I could have ate bugs, if I had to," he added, boasting.
Kira half-listened to his tale as she continued to smooth the cloth in her hand. She had yearned so for blue. Now here it was, in her grasp.
Then, when I got to the place, them people, they give me food. They got lots.
But not a bath, Kira teased. Matt scratched his dirty knee with dignity and ignored her.
They was horrid surprised to see me come, but they give me plenty of food. Branchy, too. They liked Branchy.
Kira looked down at the dog, asleep now at her feet, and nudged him affectionately with the tip of her sandal.
Of course they did. Everybody loves Branch. But Matt...
What?
Who are they, the people who have blue?
He lifted his thin shoulders and wrinkled his forehead in an expression of ignorance.
Dunno, he said. Them be all broken, them people. But there be plenty of food, and it's quiet-like and nice.
What do you mean, broken? He gestured toward her twisted leg.
Like you. Some don't walk good, some be broken in other ways. Not all, but lots. Do you think it making them quiet and nice to be broken?
Puzzled by his description, Kira didn't answer. Pain makes you strong, her mother had told her. She had not said quiet or nice.
Anyways, Matt went on, them got blue for certain sure.
For certain sure, Kira repeated.
I suppose you like me best now, I?
He grinned at her, and she laughed and said she liked him best of all. Matt pulled away from her and went to the window. On tiptoe, he peered down and then out. The crowds were still there, but he seemed to be looking beyond them for something. He frowned.
You like the blue? He asked her.
Matt, she said passionately, I love the blue. Thank you.
It be the small gifty, but the big one be coming soon, he told her.
He continued watching through the window.
Not yet, though.
He turned to her.
Got food? He asked. If and I wash?
They left Matt and Branch in Thomas's room when they were summoned back to the afternoon section of the gathering. This time they were ushered in and took their seats with less formality. There was no need for the chief guardian to introduce them to the villagers. But the singer, looking refreshed after lunch and a rest, made a ceremonial entrance again. He held his staff as he stood at the foot of the stage, and the audience applauded him in acknowledgement of his remarkable performance in the morning. His expression didn't change. It had not changed all day. No proud smile. He simply stood gazing with intensity at the populace, the people for whom the song was an entire history, the story of their upheavals, failures, and mistakes, as well as the telling of new tries and hopes. Kira and Thomas applauded as well, and Jo, watching and imitating them, clapped her hands enthusiastically. Through the noise of the applause, as the singer turned and mounted the stairs to the stage, Kira glanced at Thomas. He had heard it too, the dull, dragging sound of metal, the same sound they had noticed in the morning before the song began. Kira looked around, puzzled. No one else seemed to notice the abrupt, heavy noise. The villagers were watching the singer as he breathed deeply in preparation. He moved to the center of the stage, closed his eyes, and fingered the staff, looking for the place. He swayed slightly. There. She had heard it again. Then, almost by accident, just for a second, she glimpsed it. Suddenly, Kira realized with horror what the sound was. But now there was only silence, and then the start of the song. Chapter 21
What's wrong, Kira? Tell me.
Thomas was following her up the stairs. The gathering had finally ended. Jo had been led away by tenders, but not before she had had an exhilarating moment of triumph. At the end of the long afternoon, when the audience stood and sang, in chorus with the singer, the magnificent Amen, So Be It that always formed the song's conclusion, the singer himself had beckoned to little Jo. Though the tyke had wriggled and dozed during the long hours, now she looked up at him with eagerness, and when it was clear that he was summoning her to join him, she scrambled down from her chair and ran enthusiastically to the stage. She stood by his side and beamed with satisfaction, waving one small arm in the air, while the people, released now from their solemnity, whistled and stamped their feet in appreciation. Kira, watching, remained motionless and silent, overwhelmed with her new knowledge and a heavy feeling that combined dread and terrible sorrow. That fear and sadness stayed with her as she limped laboriously upstairs and Thomas urged her to explain what was wrong. She took a deep breath and prepared herself to tell him what she knew. But at the top of the staircase, they were interrupted by the sight of Matt in the corridor outside Kira's open door. He was grinning broadly and dancing impatiently from foot to foot. "It's here," Matt called. "The big gifty." Kira entered the room and stopped just inside the door. She stared curiously at the stranger, who sat slumped wearily in her chair. She could tell from his long legs that the man was quite tall. There was gray in his hair, though he was not old. Three syllables, she thought, trying to categorize him in some way that would perhaps explain his presence. Yes, three syllables, about the same as Jameson, maybe the age of her mother's brother, she decided. She nudged Thomas. "Look," she whispered, indicating the color of the man's loose shirt. "Blue." The intruder stood and turned toward her at the sound of her voice and at the continued bursts of Matt's barely contained excitement. Kira wondered briefly why he had not risen when she entered. It would have been the expected gesture for even the most inconsiderate or hostile stranger, and this man appeared to be both friendly and courteous. He was smiling slightly, but now she could see, to her distress, that he was blind. Scars crossed and disfigured his face with jagged lines across his forehead and down the length of one cheek, and his eyes were opaque and unseeing. She had never seen anyone with destroyed vision before, though she had heard of such things happening through accident or disease. But damaged people were useless. They were always taken to the field. Why was this sightless man alive? Where had Matt found him? And why was he here? Matt was still prancing about with anticipation. "I brung him," he announced gleefully. He touched the man's hand and demanded confirmation. "I brung you, didn't I?"
"You did," the man said, and his voice was affectionate toward the tyke. "You were a wonderful guide. You brought me almost all the way."
"I brung him all the way from yonder," Matt said, turning to Kira and Thomas. "But then, at the end, he wanted to feel his way alone. I be telling him he can keep Branchy for a helper, but he want to do it all alone, so he give me the scrap for the first gifty. See?"
Matt pulled at the man's shirt and showed Kira the hem at the back from which he had torn the piece of cloth.
"I'm sorry," Kira said politely to the man. She felt awkward and uncertain in his presence. "Your shirt is ruined."
"I have others," the man said with a smile. "He wanted so badly to show you the gift, and I felt a need to find my way by myself. I have been here before, but it was a long time ago."
"And look!"
Matt was like a toddler or a puppy, dashing about in excitement. He picked up a bag from the floor beside the chair and pulled its drawstring open.
"Now we be needing some water," he said, lifting several wilted plants out gently. "But these be all right. They be perking up when we give them a drinky." "But you never be guessing what."
Now he turned to the blind man again and tugged at his sleeve to be certain he was paying attention.
"What?"
The man seemed amused.
"She got water right here. You probably be thinking we gotta take these plants to the river. But right here, if an eye open this door, she got water that squirts out."
He pranced to the door and opened it.
"Take the plants then, Matt," the man suggested, "and give them their drink."
He turned toward Kira, and she could tell that he knew how to feel her presence in his darkness. "It's woad we've brought you," he explained. "It's the plant that my people use to make blue dye."
"Your beautiful shirt," she murmured, and he smiled again. Matt told me that it's the same shade as the sky on a sunny summer start morning, he said. Kira agreed.
Yes, she said. That's it, exactly.
Much the same as the blossom on a morning glory vine, I would think, the man said.
Yes, that's true. But how...
I haven't always been sightless. I remember those things. They could hear the sound of running water.
Matt, don't drown them, the man called. It would be a very long trip back to get more.
He turned back to Kira. I would be happy to bring more, of course, but I think you won't need that.
Please, Kira said, sit down, and we'll have a meal sent up. It's time for dinner anyway.
Even in her confusion, she tried to remember the basic courtesies. The man had brought her a gift of great value. Why he had done it, she couldn't begin to comprehend, nor how hard it must have been to come a great distance with no eyes and no guide but a lively boy and a bent-tailed dog. And at the last of the journey, when Matt had run ahead with his treasured scrap of blue, the blind man had come alone. How was it possible?
I'll call the tenders and tell them, Thomas said.
The man looked startled and concerned.
Who's that? He asked, hearing Thomas's voice for the first time. I live down the hall, Thomas explained. I carved the singer's staff while Kira did the robe. Maybe you don't understand about the gathering, but it's just ended, and it's really important.
I know about it, the man said. I know all about it.
Please, don't call for food, he added firmly. No one must know that I'm here.
Food?
Matt asked, emerging from the bathroom.
I'll have them bring our dinners to my room, down the hall, and no one will know, Thomas suggested. We'll all share it. There's always more than enough.
Kira nodded agreement, and Thomas left the room to summon the tenders. Matt scampered behind him, alert to the prospect of food. Now Kira found herself alone with the stranger in the blue shirt. She could tell from his posture that he was very tired. She sat down, facing him, on the edge of the bed, and sought in her mind the right things to say to him, the right questions to ask.
"Matt's a good boy," she said after a moment's silence. "But he forgets some important things in his excitement. He didn't tell you my name. I'm Kira."
The blind man nodded. "I know. He told me all about you." She waited. Finally, into the quiet, she said, "He didn't tell me who you are." The man stared with his unseeing eyes into the room, beyond the place where Kira sat. He began to speak, faltered, took a breath, then stopped. "It's beginning to get dark," he said finally. "I'm facing the window and I can feel the change in daylight."
"Yes."
"It's how I found my way here after Matt left me at the edge of the village. We had planned to wait and arrive at night in the darkness, but there were no people about, so it was safe for us to enter in daylight. Matt realized it was the day of the gathering."
"Yes," Kira said. "It began very early in the morning." "He is not going to answer my question," she thought.
"I remember the gatherings, and I remember the path. The trees have grown, of course, but I could feel the shadows. I could feel my way along the center of the path by the way the light fell." He smiled wryly. "I could smell the butcher's hut." Kira nodded and chuckled. "And when I passed the weaving shed, I could smell the fabrics folded there, and even the wood of the looms. If the women had been at work, I would have recognized the sounds." With his tongue against the roof of his mouth, he made the repetitive, muted, clacking sound of the shuttle, and then the whisper of the threads turning into cloth. "And so I made my way here all alone. Matt met me then and brought me to your room."
Kira waited. Then she asked, "Why?"
As she watched, he touched his own face. He ran his hand over the scars, feeling the edges. Then he followed the jagged skin down the side of his own cheek, along his neck. Finally, he reached into his blue shirt and pulled forward the leather thong that hung there. As he held it in his hand, she saw the polished half-rock that matched her own. "Kira," he said, but he did not need to tell her now because she knew. "My name is Christopher. I'm your father." In shock, she stared at him.